Watch this.
Well, hello and welcome back to part two of Sam and Tom monologue about Wales.
In partnership with FootJoy.
Welcome back, Thomas. Quick coffee break. Got the cameras rolling again.
I imagine this is 3 days later for some people, but yeah, quick coffee break.
Yeah.
Cameras back up and rolling.
I hope you've had a good 3 days. I know it's been a desperate 3 days waiting for the second part of this episode to land.
I can imagine people are just on tenterhooks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
To see what happened on the drive to Borth.
We have millions of people with no sleep in them over the last 3 days as they wait to hear how our drive to Borth and Innes last was.
Revved up on caffeine. just thinking about how they're going to get through.
Anyway. So, drive to Borth. We should say we got so lucky with weather on this trip. I know it doesn't feel like that because we got thoroughly drenched on the last day. But the number of times we played and somehow managed to squeeze it in around the rain, I thought was quite spectacular.
Yeah, we got lucky. And actually, the second day, there wasn't much rain at all. It's not like you dodged it. There just wasn't really much. I think there might be a little bit in the drive.
Well, that's it. There was an hour and 40s worth of rain.
In between.
On an hour and 40s drive.
And Borth and Innes Lass. For those people who are unfamiliar with Borth and Innes Lass, it's not very far. There is an estuary which has Aber Dyfi on the north and Borth and Innes Lass on the south.
Hmm.
And you could fly a drone between them if you wanted to.
Did you?
No, I did not. But you could fly a drone between them. There's about 500 metres between them.
Not much, is it?
But yeah. About a 40-minute drive if you want to drive from one to the other.
Annoyingly, Aber Dyfi is in the north, so we've sort of...
Yeah, for some reason we did the south one before we went back to the north. But we drove about an hour and quarter from Harlech to Borth. And few things about Borth and Innes Lass. It is a gorgeous little Welsh coastal town that has got these multicoloured houses and wonderfully long coastline that runs for miles as far as you can see. And as you drive in, I think first impressions is the road, does it bisect or dissect?
I think either. I think dissect would be
equal.
I think bisect is sort of running through the middle of, whereas I think if you dissect, you're cutting it apart. I think it's an act of slicing it. So yeah. I think either works in what you're saying. I think
the road bisects.
I'd go bisect. Bit American, but my only reason.
The first hole is on the left hand. Well, depends on which side you look at. The first hole is on the inland side of the road, as is the 15th, as is the 16th.
So I'm just
17th and 18th. Yeah. No, just sorry. My apologies. The first, the 17th and the 18th are on the inland side of the road.
Yeah.
And then 2 to 16 are on the coastal side of the road.
Yes.
And the road runs perpendicular to, it runs parallel to the coastline. So you've got this road that runs all the way along the coastline, and then suddenly you're driving through a golf course. There's golf holes on your right for a while, and then some golf holes on your left a little bit, and then you see the clubhouse on your left. Now, first impressions of Borth and Innes Lass.
Rustic.
Rustic.
I would say the first five holes at Borth, which are the ones
you
can...
thinking clubhouse.
Okay, clubhouse vibes. There's like a modern starter's hut, which looks like kind of like right by the first tee, but the clubhouse is set back. Looks like a sort of fairly modest 1970s clubhouse. Nice. Went in there, very friendly. Caterers, you know, kind of all good. Then popped into the pro shop. Did not expect what I opened. It was like Aladdin's cave.
The pro shop. For any of you that are into retro gear.
It's iconic.
The pro shop is mecca.
It is absolutely iconic.
Like everything about it is retro. Everything. You walk through, it's got a musty smell. It's got an old carpet. There's like Sounder irons. There's like McGregor irons.
You can't
irons.
Pay
There's
by cash or by card.
I think you could pay cash, but you definitely couldn't pay card. You have to wire the money.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, can you bank transfer me this money? I'm like, have you received it? She's like, I won't know for a few days. It's like, okay. So
I think they prefer checkbook.
And there's, you know, persimmon woods. You bought a Joe Powell persimmon.
Yeah.
There's Luke, who we haven't mentioned. It's shockingly, Luke's our latest member of the team at Cookie Jar. He's the content creator who has been traveling around filming us and photographing us.
Did a wonderful job. Great lad, Luke.
Really, really good lad. Great job in his first week of Cookie Jar. He bought an old metal wood.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the brand was, but
you can't say the brand, can you? Because
unless it was
in breach of your Titleist contract. But there are other golf brands.
A non-Titleist metal wood that was kind of just like a 1980s thing. It was amazing.
But all the shirts, all the stuff is still in its wrapper, like old Slazenger jumpers, old Pringle jumpers, all these, these are things that. Yeah, I think my dad was buying these in the 1980s.
They had
and they're still selling. I'm confused whether... I don't think they're buying the stock to make it retro. I think they're still trying to shift stock from 40 years ago.
But they had a couple of sets of Masters head covers, 5x3 wood driver.
Yeah.
They were yellow with the green emblem. For £20, and they have furry Masters head covers. It was it was mind-blowing stuff.
We should 100% have a retro event at Borth.
Oh,
It was on, and then they were really lovely.
The clothing was all that Pringle diamond.
I think that was what was giving off the musty smell.
Oh.
It was a delight. It really did. It just when you go and see something like that, it just makes an experience there so much more magical. I love the fact that it's so authentic and it's so them that's the way they're running it. You can buy new balls and stuff there, but it's really part of the experience of going there is having a good poke around in there. I really didn't need to buy a Persimmon driver. I really didn't. And I sort of said, look, I think I tried to sneak a bit off it or whatever and said, look, I'll give you this because I think it'd been reshafted or something. And they were like, oh, do it for this. And I sort of thought...
Why are you whispering? It's not a podcast.
I know, sorry. But I ended up buying this Joe Powell Persimmon and I absolutely loved it. I mean, the two real stars of that tour were Luke and the Joe Powell Persimmon for me. And actually, it was quite nice because I put it straight in the bag.
And the toothbrush that cleaned the shoes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I loved it. But my first impressions of the course when you get there is because you drive through the first five or so holes, you tend to see the stuff that's quite low profile. It's very flat. It's very basic up and down golf. So you head out, and you're just enjoying it with the sun on your back. But you then play a par five where you have to get past this house. I can see you're itching to come in, but just give me a second. Then you get past that house and you're like, oh, wow.
Well, the reason being is that house is on the corner of the road you drive in.
Correct.
So when you come up to the T-junction, you see that house and you turn left. So everything you see from the drive in is dead flat, mega dead flat. It's just on the coast. It's Lynx land, but it's dead flat.
Yes.
And that's all you've ever seen from the drive in. One last thing before we leave the clubhouse, because I don't want to miss this. It would be remiss if we don't talk about it at the end. The people there were so welcoming and so friendly. At the end of the round, when they were closed up and having a committee meeting, and we sat there because Luke had gone off to do some filming with the drone and we sat outside, they came out and they were like, no charge, bringing us beers, going, boys, just have some beers. We can't serve you anything because we're having a committee meeting, but have some beers, sit here and chill out. You've had a nice day. I'd say, I mean, everyone was friendly, but they were
hyper mega friendly. It was actually a very magical afternoon it was quite nice weather. It was sunny in parts, but it wasn't until we got to the 18th tee box and then we'd been watching the sun and Luke is sort of poised with the drone and it just dipped below the clouds and it went magical.
Yeah.
For a very brief, you looked across up the bay and you could see Abu Dhabi with all the haze and everything where the sun had dipped. And it was just glorious walking off that 18th tee and sitting there. There was minutes of sunlight remaining and having a beer and they were just so nice. Now, there's a few bits about Borth, which before we get onto the golf course, like to perhaps if you'd indulge me. I mentioned that they claim that they are the oldest club in Wales or the first place to play the game of golf in Wales. That I think that's something that will be the subject of ongoing discussion. Colt was involved. However, not until about 1947. So it was Colt's company. Need more data on this, but I'm guessing this is a bit more sort of Allison and Morrison really by then. But I feel like Borth as a club has one where it's had its fortunes have swung radically throughout its history. You know, it's a really old club. You know, they had a decent payout during the sort of Second World War, which is why they got Colt involved to do some stuff, because, you know, military would have taken over and done some damage to the course and had to sort of like requisition elements of it. So part of that compensation, as what I understand, paid for Colt's involvement. And very recently, last few years, my understanding was that the club was on the brink of closure or was in financial difficulty. And, you know, we met some of those members that were on the board having their board meeting, and they were super passionate, really nice people, really cared about it. And that was great. And I also understand that there's a few people from perhaps the Uppingham School, which is a Midland public school, also sort of lent their support. And that harks back to a period of time where Uppingham School moved 300 of their pupils down to Borth.
During the war?
Yes. Bromsgrove did the same. They went down to, I think it was Aberystwyth. Hmm. Well, it wasn't during the war. It was actually in the late 1800s when there was a massive outbreak of typhoid.
Really?
Yes. So, interesting. And I think there's, you know, there's probably more to be done. You know, I'd maybe try and put this into a little blog post just around the fortunes of Borth and try and get the real official stuff, because I don't want to get it wrong. But I sense that it is where it is because there's lots of passionate people around that club who really have made it their work over the last 20 or 30 years to keep it going. And I'm really glad they did, because the course is excellent.
Yeah, and it was interesting chatting to some of those board members when they kindly came out and gave us beers and, you know, had a chinwag.
They were having a Borth meeting.
Lots of them were, or a few of them were member of Aberdovey or Harlech, but you could tell, like, this is where their passion was, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It was, yes, they played their golf up there as well, but this was where their passion was. And I think they said they had about 300 members. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but let's delve into the course a smidge.
Well, I think the meat of the discussion needs to sit on the holes when you get past that par five, which I think is the fourth.
We can get into that.
But before we do get there, if you like boundary golf, you're going to love Borth, because the first four holes and the last six holes are played with seriously penal boundaries. None is more emphasised than the second tee shot, where the road runs to the right of the hole and the fence out of bounds left to the beach. And you're standing there and it is a no-miss tee shot. Like, Jim, who was holding a couple of point lead on you to avoid the shoe cleaning.
He played very well in Harlech.
He did play very well at Harlech. And then you didn't have your best stuff, and I think you just, you know, just missed a few or whatever. He's 2 points clear. And then going into that afternoon, he's fully yipped it down the first. He's just, you know, it's all going on in his head. He's thinking, I don't want to clean shoes again. I really, really don't want to clean these shoes tonight. So, mate, you both picked up a pair of blobs or something. So he's still no danger. He's still sort of like, yeah, he's got his nose in front. And then he's hit this just huge cut block out of bounds off the second tee.
Mega slice.
Pulls the provisional, hits a duck hook left. I mean, it's this thing still going up over the beach. And, you know, it's funny. You look at the messages when you post something at Borth and Innislas. Friend of the pod, Charlie, message says, second hole at Borth, toughest in Wales. By
I think it's the hardest in the world.
It's insane. That's just a stretch.
Just to put, you know, to paint the picture of the second at Borth and Innislas. You play the first, which is you tee off hugging the road, and the road's to your left, and the green is hugging the road's to your left. Horrible golf hole, really, in terms of you know you can't go left, and there's not a ton of room right, but you know you can't go left. You get through the first hole. You cross, and now you've got the road on your right and the beach on your left. And the fairway can only be at most 30 yards wide. Now, we played it on a dead still day. When the wind is blowing there, that has to be the hardest hole on the planet. It has to be.
I think 30 yards is maybe a smidge over-egged, but yes.
What, 90 paces? 30 yards? Or 30 paces?
I don't know.
It can't have been
much
more than that.
We'll have to get on Google Maps. I think more than anything, it's just the intimidating aspect of out-of-bounds right and out-of-bounds left. And it was just terrifying. And I've had this bloody Joe Powell persimmon. I'd hit once and thought, oh, I just blocked it a bit down the first. So I sort of budgeted for that with the second shot. which is the start of the love affair. It really was.
Duncan McCarthy stuff, complete resignation.
Yeah, you play with just complete resignation and just show up and give it your best stuff. But I do think, you know, we need to talk, you know, not in excessive detail, but very briefly. I think that run when you get past that par five where the sign on the tee says to you, do not play over the house. Because everything is short grass at Borth. Everything is short grass. And you basically have to get from tee to green on this par five, and there's a house coming in from the road with slap netting around it, and you've got to get around this thing. So, you know, they cut it off at the pass on the tee and say you can't play over it. And after that, it all opens up because you walk around that corner and then you just see loads of dunes and you're like, oh, now I get it. Now I know why people have said come and play golf here. Because you then start to play five, that little short four with the green benched into a massive dune, massive descending par three to follow. You play a whole run of holes out to the turn, and then you play back along this sort of huge Linksland. You've got a few blind drives with marker posts, and oh, it was just a delight. I absolutely loved it.
And that stretch around the turn is so quirky and so blind.
It's cool.
There's a hole around about 12, I would have thought, that's a complete blind drive. And you're just given, it's dunes everywhere. And you see this marker post and it's just saying, hit me. The hole's 300 yards. You don't know where it's going off this marker post. If there's room left, if there's room right. And it's majestic. And as this was going on, it was overcast all day with this break of about, as you look at it, like an inch and a half between the cloud and the horizon. Mm. In the distance in the west, and you think in any moment that sun is going to pop its little head out underneath that cloud and before the horizon, and it just started to come out around 13-14, and it was just such a magical finish to that round.
It was good. Now I think I put together probably my best bird my best bird golf round there. I mean, it's quite open, you know, you can open your shoulders a bit around there, but I was really feeling it. I was striking it really nicely. So I felt like I'd probably got enough daylight and I wasn't going to be getting my hands dirty on golf clubs that day. Cleaning shit.
You do want to take over for a bit? You feel like you need to have a little...
Yeah, so luckily anyway, the camera stopped recording whilst I was having a choking fit. Best golf I played, I think. So I managed to get a bit of daylight between you and Jim. And I believe you were having a bit of a pillow fight for a while.
No, not really.
But you eventually started playing some quite good stuff after about four holes, didn't you?
Yeah, I was. It wasn't really a pillow fight in terms of I was.
It was quite close though, wasn't it?
Four up going down.
Were you?
Than the last two, yeah. Do you remember? Because I had to explode on 17, but then I knocked it. I tell a lie, in the previous thing, it is 16, 17, 18, which is on the left hand side of the road, because 16 is a par three and there's two par fours to finish. So.
Yes.
So, yeah, we all parred that par three, the 16th, and then I needed to blob the last two, but I parred coming in on par 17, then it didn't really matter on 18.
Yeah, and Jim was a very sad dog, wasn't he?
He was a sad dog, yeah. He was, I think it takes a skill to, it's not a skill, but a hardened fellow to be away from your family for so long and be tired. Like there was a lot of tiredness.
You've got to be comfortable being tired, haven't you?
36 whole day. You know, it takes a certain skill just to get around all that. So yeah, he had the best time. We were sat outside Borth and Innislas and we'd had the beers and we were trying to contemplate what we were going to do in the evening. And we decided that because I was doing the driving and I don't know why you decided you couldn't look after food, but we asked Jim to sort out the food sitch, which up in Abu Dhabi, the food sitch wasn't plentiful.
Had you been to Abu Dhabi before?
I've not done any of Mid Wales before.
It's really nice, isn't it? Yeah. It's glorious.
Beautiful, beautiful place, yeah.
It is a glorious little place.
Fishing village.
So whilst he, is that recording?
No. I don't know why he keeps doing that.
So, I mean, obviously then pulling into Abu Dhabi, what a place, what a great sort of little holiday resort it is. beautiful coloured cottages everywhere. Just lovely. Abu Dhabi, the next morning, we decided to move back our tea time from, well, we were going to play at first light and then drive to St. David's City, which felt like a little bit too much, probably, in the context of 3 hours rainfall in the morning. So we would much rather have seen Abu Dhabi in all its pomp.
Yeah,
I'm glad we moved it back, actually.
To sacrifice, you know, Abu Dhabi in absolute torrential rain.
Yeah.
To go play to St. David's City, which is a little nine holer, which, as good as it might have been, I think it would have been...
It was the right call, wasn't it?
Would have been a bit daft. So.
Which actually worked brilliantly, didn't it? Because what it meant was we got to the club early, and a friend of the pod, Michael Whitehead, nice, good writer, does some golf travel stuff on England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, etc. He put us in touch with a chap called Dave, who is the club's archivist from, again, Midlands, bit of a recurring theme here, up near Warsaw. He has put a truly staggering amount of effort into cataloguing the archives that he stumbled across. And I'm sure we got loads of stuff in the film and stuff that we can include from this. But again, just a brilliantly like passionate guy who stumbled across this and made it his, you know, 10, 20 years worth of work to catalogue and archive it, build out that Darwin room. So for anyone who doesn't know a huge amount about Abu Dhabi, Darwin is like very, very central to the story. It was like a really significant place for him. So whilst he lived out his days in Rye, which was another special place, I know he wrote extensively about a lot of golf courses, but Abu Dhabi was a place of real meaning for him. And the stuff that you find there is brilliant. Like, you remember when he showed us the newspaper clippings from the Times, and you've got, I mean, you've got probably about 2,000 words dedicated to the Children's Championship played that day at Abu Dhabi. Meanwhile, the US amateur in 1929 receives nothing more than about two or three sentences written by Darwin.
Yeah, it's like Francis Weymouth. It's like literally a paragraph. Yeah. At the bottom, it's like, oh, Francis Weymouth has done this. It's like,
it's mental. It's absolutely mental. I mean, imagine being Darwin and just thinking, I can just do what I want. I mean, if that was given to me now, it would basically be the Times would be covering the Blackwell Monthly medals and happenings within the club and what we're doing to our greens and literally barely mentioning anything else. You know, like that's kind of what I felt Darwin was doing back then.
He was just living the dream, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So what's Darwin's connection with Abu Dhabi? Because he's not from around there.
No, Dave talked about it specifically, but I think he went there on holiday. Was it something to do with his in-laws, or did his uncle or something marry someone from near, was it
Machanclith? Yeah,
Machanclith.
That'll do.
So that area became a bit of a holiday place, and then he's just always gravitated towards it. And when you drive into Abu Dhabi, there is a railway line, and that is absolutely central to the golf course as well. It underpins the strategy of a large amount of the golf. But you know, I sit there and think, God, I'd love to go back in time and watch Darwin get off the train there.
Yeah,
in the golden days,
wander down with his clubs.
Cantankerous bloke, by all accounts, actually.
Yeah, and
he was interesting.
And he was a president at Abu Dhabi.
Yes. Yeah.
So this isn't just like, oh yeah, Darwin liked it. No, he's seriously integral to Abu Dhabi as a place.
100%. Now, a little before Darwin's time, there was a character called Colonel Ruck, who he was sort of like the first person to get golf going down there. I think he'd played a few holes at Formby, obviously got quite taken with the idea, and then went and got 9 flower pots from a local girl and put them in the links and started playing to them, and that's how it all started.
Is that right?
I don't know. I can kind of imagine Colonel Ruck as being quite an interesting character. White-haired, moustache, flamboyant colours, probably quite portly, I would imagine, as well.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Colonel Ruck was thin, can you?
No. And Abu Dhabi was the place where the Welsh Golfing Union was set up. Mm-hmm. And they founded the course. Now, I don't really... We're going to get these dates wrong, but I think it's something along the lines of the camp founded the club in 1892 and they started playing in 1896.
I think you might be right there. I haven't got those stats to hand.
I think there was something in between either 1895, 1896 is when the course opened for play. It's a long time to have a club without a course. But the Welsh Golfing Union was established at Abu Dhabi. So again, this is now across the estuary from Borth, who apparently had the first knock of a golf ball. So, you know, the history is pretty rife.
And like you were saying with Harlech as well, the dunes, sorry to jump in, but the dunes, in the same way that the land is quite dynamic at Harlech, it's very dynamic at Abu Dhabi. And I think that's why it's moved around quite a bit, because you've obviously got the early golf that was played there. You know, I think he was talking about golf being played much further inland in the early days. You've got a primitive layout. Yeah. You've got Fowler was like, you know, that he's probably a core contributor to the course that you play today, Fowler, and in terms of his input. Braid was also involved, as was Colt. I think Colt undid some Braid stuff. You've got Ian Woosnam that's working there now with DJ Russell, putting in Darwin tees, lengthening it. I mean, the stretch in against the prevailing breeze is not to be underestimated. It's a serious challenge of golf.
Mm. Was that prevailing? Was it the breeze we played?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, so you turn and play that head on coming in.
That was tough.
But I'd say the real, I mean, for me, the real magic part of it is where you hit that little sort of shoulder of the land. So you play a couple of holes in one direction and probably turn 20 or 30 degrees to play a bit further up the coast. And that little awkward corner is almost like creased in with more dunes. And you've got holes like the 16th, which are just sensational.
Yeah. The whole thing, the whole course doglegs around to the right.
Yeah.
It follows the bend in the land, which almost changes the direction of the wind. Every hole as you kind of progress around this dogleg of the land. And then as you get to, I think, seventh green is probably the furthest part of the course.
Yeah.
You come back a little bit, go back out again. And then a majestic par three. Now, there aren't many tremendous uphill par threes on the planet.
No.
To all intents and purposes, if you want to really destroy a par three, play it uphill. But this par three, I can't even remember. Is it the 10th? It's got to be around that. 10, 11, 9. But it's absolutely
I would have said 11th if I had a gun to my head.
It's about 100, and I think we played at about 150. It's, you know,
into a stiff breeze.
25 feet elevated in a big volcano green that all drops down in front of you. It drops down to the left of you. It behind is dunes, so it's, you've lost your ball, and the right is nothing but ocean, yeah. Nothing but the Irish Sea. So it's just such, and the wind was howling. For us, it was like into and slightly out of the right. And I can't even remember, I think I took a 6-iron into that up, yeah, up that same hill.
Hammered it, absolutely hammered it as well.
And it hammered. Was hammered. And it was majestic little par three. And then you play a fairly brutal stretch of long fours and long fives coming in. And 16 is probably the standard hole on the golf course, ostensibly a drivable par four. But I mean, whether you go for it, you know, back on the roadside of the golf course, it's a figure of eight. Mm. I mean, I don't know whether Colt was taking his inspiration from dear old Muirfield, but the whole course figures of eight. So 1, 2, 3, 4 are on the dunes, and then 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kind of back on the roadside. And then, you know, sort of up to about 15 is on the dunes, and you cross 16, 17, 18 and back on the roadside. So yeah, it's a wonderful golf course. I wasn't prepared to cross the railway, because the car park's on the other side of the railway line. You've got these gates that say, if you leave the gate open, I mean, you're gonna be fined a million times before you get to Abu Dhabi. If you leave the gate open, it's £1,000 fine.
If you lose the key for your Airbnb, you're gonna get fined for that.
£1,000 fine. There was another £1,000 fine, like dog foul in charge or something like that. So it was like, honestly, there was, but if you left this railway gate open, you had to cross by foot to get to the course. And then the pro shop's on your left, the clubhouse is on your right. And as you sort of appear out, you know, the course was in great condition. You can see it with your eyes. It's like that shiny grass. The dunes are massive. Dunes are like framing the golf course around. And I just wasn't prepared to see it.
It was excellent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I quite like the subtlety of it as well. Like, I think Clyde talked about it on the podcast about the reversible 18 at the old course. You know, realize that the old course does have directional change. It's just more subtle.
Yeah.
So you're not triangulated, but you're just moving 10 degrees at a time. So that brings in a bit of variety with the wind. I thought, you know, the closing stretch is really tough. Like that puts you under, you know, it's a proper examination of your ball striking. It stands up as a good test of golf. But then some of the greens are excellent. You know, short par three to the third. It's that little punch bowl green. First green, staggering. 16th green, amazing. Par three up the hill, which for the life of me, we can't remember the number of the hole.
It's a problem we're playing six courses in 4 days. The whole, you're absorbing the whole a lot, numbers, aren't you? Sometimes you lose them.
Yeah, so... but it was really, really, really good fun. I thought the one thing that they've got is a lot of these little drainage ditches, and you just can't see them.
Yeah.
Like, I would actually suggest, I don't encourage this very often, get a course planner. Like,
yeah,
you actually, like, I blocked the first tee shot because you don't want to go left into the dunes, so just spray it right. And I sprayed it right, got down. I was about a foot away from being in red stakes.
Yeah.
Which you can't go in that stuff, mate. You won't get the ball back. So, but yeah, really nice. Great team. Like, the whole thing was just it's a joy to go there. And it definitely, the same as Harlech, really, in so much as I can't believe it's been like 25 years since I've gone back there, and it won't be next time because they're just really good places. Now, because Abu Dhabi was an 18-hole day, we were playing.
We're not done. After the round at Abu Dhabi,
Newcastle,
we went up to get some food. We were going to be driving down to Tenby, which is a long stretch, so we decided to go get some food in the clubhouse. The club had kindly given us a little corner that we could get the MacBooks out because we had all the camera equipment stuff and backing up some footage and doing those bits. So we're in this little kutch around the corner.
Kutch.
Having a beer and backing up some footage. And then the member of staff comes along. Did you catch his name? No. But he works behind the bar there. And he came out and said, "Boys, how are you doing? I just want to give you a bit of fun. I'm a bit of a Newcastle savant." Quote, Newcastle savant. I was like, whoa. He's like, "Do any of you watch football?" So, a little bit, I suppose, yeah. I don't watch any. So that was in Operation Blag right now. And then he said it to you. So do you remember the exact time frame? I think it was 30 years.
So he basically said you can name any Newcastle United Premier League match in history. So we're going back to, 91 or something here. 1991, I think, was the first season of the Premier League. You can name me the date and who we played against, and I will tell you the goal scorers, what the card situation was, and the score. I'm thinking, there's hundreds, dare I say, thousands of games in that sort of
1400. He claimed
30 odd.
1400 games.
He's got the cups and all.
He's
that
got
sort
the
of
noggin.
Stuff. So I just go on some random search, pulled out a few completely random. This wasn't like a mind trick where you name an odd number, two digit odd number, 37. It's not like that. I pulled out a few of these, and it was unbelievable.
He didn't let you finish.
It was like, that's against Southampton. You said Shearer scored twice. One of them was a penalty. There's a red card for so-and-so. There was an own goal with this person. It was 3-0. Another one, it was 2-2. It was too easy.
Said something like September 14th, 1994. And then, because he'd said name and who we were playing or something that. And he didn't even stop. He's like, we played this team. This was the score. These were the goal scorers. It was no goals, red card. It was like, holy hell.
Can you imagine?
You wouldn't have any of it. You're like, no, we're doing it again. And then the bloke absolutely gamed us and was like, well, look, I don't give this away for free. if you want me to do it again, I'll bet you a beer. And if I get it right, you've got to buy me a beer. And you said, done. And then
he
smashed it again and you had to go buy him a beer. But
can you imagine if you could get that knowledge for major championship golf? Like,
it was
that would be some party trick. Stuff. I can name the top 10.
He then showed us he'd done it with some people that kind of knew Alan Shearer or something, and they got him on the phone. They're like, "Alan, ask him a question about Newcastle United," and he smashed it. And he's got this video of Alan Shearer going, "Your knowledge of Newcastle is phenomenal."
Kind of epitomised the club, though. Just a very friendly place to be. Really good. Now, we should talk about the golf briefly. You didn't have your finest stuff there.
No, I lost my way for 14 holes.
Jim played his best stuff.
The good thing about golf is it always gives you something. Mm. The last few holes, it was okay.
Yes. Because you were fighting the elements and actually you just fell back into process.
I was using expletives.
You got back into Gabbitas mode and it was all good.
Yeah.
So the tough part was we were in the van and you had a 3.5 hour journey ahead of you, and we didn't get there down to Tenby till late, and then we had to decamp with all the kit and the cameras and the laptops, and you wanted to stop at Aberaeron for drinks.
Should we have a moment about that?
Yeah, we can do.
Aberaeron is a place that I've and my family have lived for well over 20 years. I was really keen to get you guys to see it. And it was halfway down, so we stopped for a drink there in the Harbourmaster Hotel, which was where we met the lovely gentleman in the bar that told us about Peretti. Beautiful little town. Anyone to go in that sort of way, that's not far from Cardigan. It's like 20 minutes from Cardigan. Mm-hmm. Cardigan Golf Club. So if you're going to play, that's a links, nice links course, Cardigan Golf Club. So good place to go. It's got a beautiful harbour. The River Iron runs through it, and it's... they're doing some sea defense work, but on a normal summer evening, you can sit out there and have a beer. It's a beautiful little place. We stopped there on the way down.
It was lovely.
It was nice.
And the bad news was when we got to Tenby and stayed in the Dormy Lodge, I did not expect Tenby to be equipped like they were with Dormy accommodation. You had to clean the clubs late at night, which was a shame. But can I add, you did a fabulous job on them. You really got into the soles with a toothbrush, which is something Jim hadn't done so far that trip. They were absolutely minty. Grooves were great. Like, the whole thing, bravo. Top job. You did that at midnight or 12:30. We were up droning 10B at about 6 a.m. Like, fair play. So, that was a hell of a shift.
Sam and I had a bit of a Barney because I was tired and I didn't want to do it. And then we'd had a Barney, and then I told you, I was like, I'm going to bed. And then Jim and I were sharing a room, and then I was cleaning the clubs at like midnight going, I have to do it now because I'm not going to give them the satisfaction of watching me. but Jim duly recorded it and sent it to you anyway. So I was kind of a bit gutted, but clubs were clean, ready to go for Tenby.
Tenby. This is the oldest golf course in Wales.
How can it be? We've just talked about two of them.
This is the problem with Welsh golf, is there's no clearly established chronology. Maybe it's a space for us to step into. I know a few people have been down there and said it's remarkable value. And I think they've invested hugely in the clubhouse and the dormy. We get there and there's couples there, 4-star bedrooms, really nice food coming out. You're like, God, I was not expecting all of this.
LEDs under the bar, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of...
It's all had a modern touch.
Yeah, it's plush.
Which is not necessarily what, you know, it's not like you don't walk in and think, God, I've walked into the oldest club in Wales here. And if I'm honest, you're sitting there thinking, God, this is all very comfortable, you know? And comfort and great golf don't always go hand in hand, I think.
In fact, they never go hand in hand.
No.
I don't know anywhere that's got a really comfortable place that...
And the dormy rooms were excellent.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely excellent.
And we weren't even in the good ones.
No, they were saying you're in the.
They're like apologising, saying we couldn't get you the suites because they're fully booked out, but we've got you in these dormy rooms,
and the rooms were epic, mega like minty. Epic, and the staff were amazing and like really helpful and just really nice people. And Tenby as a town is not a stag and hen capital of Wales
anymore.
It's actually really gentrified, and we didn't get to the Harbour Brewery, which everyone had recommended we stop at. But it's just a really nice place. And
I'm not suggesting anybody do this either, but we got there quite late. And I think we got there probably 9:45.
Yeah.
Bar was closing at 11, so we had a couple of Guinness. We asked if we could do food, and they said, I'm really sorry, the kitchen's just closed. But if you sit in the corner and don't bother anyone, you can get a Domino's delivered here and you can eat it in the corner. So we're in the clubhouse.
Don't bother anyone or argue.
Which we did 50% of that. But we sat in the clubhouse drinking Guinness and eating Domino's.
I've got to say, Domino's is an absolutely appalling food business.
The
pizza
needs
is so
must.
Bad, and it makes you feel atrocious the next day.
Needs must.
I actually cannot speak badly enough about Domino's, and yet it's a trap you fall into on a, you know, six times a year, don't you?
That would be a
but all this sort of stuff. I guess what I'm saying is, we got there at night, didn't see the golf course, really comfortable, really good rooms. Everything's been modern. I'm just thinking, I'm not feeling like I'm going to set foot on a great golf course tomorrow. I'm sort of feeling like all of this stuff going on, golf's going to be a bit of an afterthought here. And I was really curious to play Tembi and have been for ages. I went down with my wife to Wales a few years ago. I really wanted to see it. Didn't really get near the golf course. But I was just, I've always been quite curious about Tembi, which is why I wanted to include it. And if I'm honest, waking up that morning, I thought, forecast is pretty miserable here. Massive winds. This the same storm that destroyed
Storm
Lisbon.
Storm Nelson.
Storm Nelson. Rain's coming in. Like, this all could be a bit of a washout today.
But because of the aforementioned argument, which is, by the way, a
wasn't a big argument.
It's a big thing of this. Once a tour thing. We have a little clear the air thing.
It's just a joust.
It was a joust, a little emotional joust. But you obviously felt bad because you were up at 6 a.m. with me droning, which is not something you usually do. But you'd come out and 6 a.m. and I'm droning, and you were saying to me, "Yeah, we'll just nip out for 9, yeah, and then we'll get ahead of this storm. We'll just nip out for 9, and then just get back in the car, and we'll get to Pennard, which is the last place." And I said, "Yeah, you know, let's just get ahead of it, and we'll play 9, and then." But the first hole looked pretty cool. I mean, you got the driving range to your left, and you do a blind drive over a marker post on the first, and you're like, "That looks quite interesting." Anyway, so let's just see how it goes. And I'm there droning it, and if I'm honest, I usually get a good feel of a place if I drone it before I go out. This day was a very peculiar day, that Storm Nelson was coming, and we knew it was coming, and we thought it was coming at 11:30. But it was a glorious sunrise, it was a clear blue sky sunrise.
A bloody biblical day.
And a glorious sunset, which we had at Pennard. But the bit in between was apocalyptic.
I mean, it was about as bad as weather as I've played in.
We knew that was coming. So it was like, oh, well, we'll drone early and then we'll just go play and we'll try and get around it by 11:30, which would have been no stress.
10:30. Balls were in the air at 7:30.
Yeah, so 10:30, which shouldn't have been a stress.
Yeah, really. Exactly. And I think, yeah, 18, slightly lower land, a little bit of water, like, you know, sort of thinking. And then there's three holes at Tembi that are in like a sort of over the road and in like some non-links land. So you know the first
four. Well, we don't
14.
Know it's not. We never saw them.
No, but I think that was the general vibe I was getting. And you play that first, and it's just crashing dunes, like rollicking fairways, great green, and then you cross through into the next bit behind the fence. You're thinking, all right, that's quite a good opening gambit, that. Must all start to sort of peter out a little bit here, because otherwise, if it carries on like this, Tembi would be much more famous than it is. You play the second, very nice green, lovely little sort of U-shaped thing in the front of the green. All looks quite nice over the Linksland. Three. Possibly the best hole we played on tour. Unbelievable green sight. Again, completely different shape. You know, dune cutting in. Cool, bloody. This is, you're thinking, God, the low point's coming at some point. Four, blind drive, massive punch bowl green, like descending down off the dunes on the top. Five, short four. Six, little tiddler of a par three. Another great green shape. You're thinking, this has got to run out of puff some point, and it just didn't.
Seven, carried on, long par four. Looks, okay, we found
looks
it.
Like
we found the ordinary
hole.
Yeah. The most outrageous green.
Yeah.
Walk a little bit forward. Eight, okay, this looks fairly flat in a way, and we're going into the farmlandy part of it. No, more links. Another outrageous green where it's two-tiered with quite a severe slope in the tier. So, like, we had a front pin, so like, oh, if you just miss the green, it's like, I'm going to fizz it in, use that backstop, and then really you can use your imagination. Nine, all world par four, dog legs round to the right with
right
a dune
off the bay,
guarding
bay.
The green. And you tee off from elevated on the beach. We didn't, because there was a hole out of play, they put 9A, which is a secondary hole, which was banging.
Yeah.
Little par three, about 155 yards. 10.
By
11,
now the rain's
12.
Come in like lashing, and yet we still didn't give up. I mean, it was biblical now by 10.
I mean,
10, 10, 11, 12,
12,
13.
12 was
14.
That. I think 12 was the...
Par three.
Amazing par three. Again, you're on the ocean and you or on the Irish Sea, and you're teeing up and you're playing parallel to the sea, and it's over a cavern and up to this
at the town,
green at the town. Winds howling in off the right, off the sea. And then we played downwind 13, played 14, which is a really lovely par five, which looks benign on the scorecard, but has this benched in green, which is like, it's arced up to the right, and it's got a huge cavernous drop off to the left. Just at that point, the problem was we were stretched for time and Storm Nelson had arrived, and that you're probably at the closest
point. It was
borderline
dangerous. I mean, it was so hard.
And you're at the closest point to the clubhouse. So these 15, 16, 17, which are the aforementioned three holes across the road, that's where they are. And we thought, well, we're right close to the clubhouse. It's now horizontal rain. 18. Tenby were a little bit nervous because there was a lot of standing water. There was a lot of standing water
everywhere.
Everywhere we played. And 18 had a lot of standing water. To a point where the fairway was pretty covered and it was hard. It would have been hard to play. That being said, the land that was a foot off the standing water was bone dry. It was just the water table was so high.
And the greens were unbelievably good surface.
Yeah.
And most of the courses we played probably had teams of six or seven. Certainly Pennard has seven. I'm guessing Harlech had similar, I believe, when I spoke to Reese. I think Abu Dhabi will have a decent team there. Tenby's got four. That's quite a small amount of greenkeepers. Mm. You know, that's obviously not in the Welsh Pool and Borth category. But the presentation of the course is unreal. And the ground was rock hard. And I just left there thinking, those 14 holes we played were 14 of some of the best green shapes I've seen. Like, really good. And it's Braid. Again, here he is again. He's now turned up in Tenby Braid. He's having another crack at this. This is obviously an early effort with him. Just brilliant.
And I think they were the best green surfaces we played on for the whole trip.
But the green shapes as well. You know, like, all of them were very different. It wasn't like, oh, they're all just raised up with runoffs or they're all punch bowls. They were all unique and all brilliant in their own way. And
a relatively easy walk.
Yeah, totally. I was actually, of all the places, I was the most surprised by Tenby. Yeah, did not expect that.
Easily the biggest surprise at all. I mean, up until that point, it took it for me. Tenby blew my mind.
It's a game of expectation though, isn't it? Like any of this stuff. And I know you always say, I don't research and I don't expect, but naturally you will have some level of expectation about Borth versus Abu Dhabi versus Harlech that you're walking into, whether it's the old course, Muirfield, whatever. You have some expectation. And Tenby was just way better than I expected it to be. And that's the magic of doing this sort of stuff. I had a nice time. Now, we had to drive about an hour and a half then to Pennard for our last round. I will say, already quite fatigued with the wind cutting us in half and getting soaked. I mean, I was freezing coming off that golf course and everything we owned was soaked.
We should take a moment for
Footjoy.
It is, we can take a moment for Footjoy if you like, but take a moment for how neither of us are able to believe forecasts.
No.
In terms of how we dress. It is dry right now, so I'm going out in dry clothes.
In my
even
dormy,
though we knew it was coming.
Yeah, I mean, in my dormy, it was like a really nice 20 degrees. It was very dry in that dormy room. There was no rain. I knew the rain was coming at 10:30, but I had no reason to believe it would come any sooner. And why would I? So I went out in chinos and a nice woolen jumper. I really like the new polos that we got from Footjoy. But I believe they do some excellent waterproof gear, but they will have to be the judge of that because I didn't have any of it with me. Why would I go into Wales for a week in March? I mean, who'd have thought it's going to bloody rain? I got soaked.
Yeah, it was pretty biblical.
Absolutely soaked.
But we've always done it. And like, it's, you know, we've got these new Lynx Master bags. They've got a million compartments. We could have put waterproofs in the compartments. Did we do it? No.
Great bags, actually.
One of them's decided to do it again. That one over there, battery exhausted.
So I just got totally soaked. And then I did it again at Pennard. So we drove an hour and a half, drying everything on the fans. Like, we're driving and I've got, if I'm honest, energy was right in the, like, it was its lowest ebb now, the energy of the tour. Jim was totally off tour. He'd got soaked. He had to come off the course once in on the way round. He forgot something. He had to come off the course twice when it rained. I mean, he was like a drowned rat. He's got a lot more hair than I have for a kickoff. But we're then driving along and we're getting close to Pennard and I'm drying the gloves on the little air vents or whatever. And then we've put Phil Collins in the air tonight and it just blew up. I think that just got us some much needed energy as we pulled into Pennard.
Probably the fourth member of the team, because Luke had gone. fourth member of the team, Phil Collins, on this trip.
Yeah, Phil Collins was like...
He was a good tourist.
He was only an adequate replacement for Luke, actually. But
yeah.
I would have actually probably sacrificed Phil to have Luke doing the photography because it was not a day to be wielding cameras out there. Get to Pennard. Backstory with Pennard, right? The hype. Doak wrote about this place a long time ago. It was a relatively anonymous, also a Braid course. Braid came back years later with Ken Cotton and built more and did more with the golf course. It is always called the Links in the Sky, which I suppose would feel like to you and me, we're thinking, okay, it's a cliff top.
Should yeah, have I've like heard, I've heard this before.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard.
I've seen
Links in the Sky. So yeah. It's basically a parkland that sits on top of a cliff.
Or
right?
Chalkland, usually.
Yeah.
Mountains are usually chalkland or like moorland. And exactly. Yeah, okay, I've seen it.
So you see the sea, but actually it doesn't play remotely like a links course. And I'm sort of thinking there's so much hype around this place, it actually can't deliver.
I was certain that Pennard was going to be the biggest disappointment of the trip.
I was with you on that. I thought there's so much hype, it just can't get there. Like I just don't understand.
And the
this.
Hype is in kind of the people. I mean, I don't know. It's the people that know what they're talking about. Mm. You know, it's in the Golf Club Atlas. It's in Doak has written about it in his confidential guide. It's people that know what they're talking about have said this thing, but I didn't know whether it just got a bit ahead of itself because it was, you know, it'd been talked about by Tom Doak, who is iconic, and he said it's good, so it must be good. You know, we'll all say it's good because Tom Doak.
Because we'll all get on that bandwagon, yeah.
However,
and then however you pull in, you're like, okay, yeah. I mean, like first impressions, it's like looks quite smoky, actually. To be fair, no, I'm kind of expecting like. Yeah, this is a level up from the sort of dramatic, cliff-toppy, you know, rolling grounds that you might sort of expect. This was like genuinely like playing golf on the moon to look at it. It was like I've never seen texture of ground quite like it. It was like completely rolling.
Well, I suppose
so one like of the things that hit, like, wow.
Yeah, and one of the things that hit me really hard is I suppose it's the same with all mountain courses or clifftop courses, is nearly every golf course that's ever been designed didn't start off with trees. They're not really carving them out of woods, because why would you? It's really hard work to do that unless you tree farm. It's why would you? You build on pasture land or links land or where there's no trees. And then the trees kind of evolve. Blackwell's a good example of that. You know, there wasn't many trees on Blackwell, now it's tree lined. Similar to Sunnydale Old, you know, it's just what happens. But because of the nature of the clifftop course there, or the mountain course, or the links in the sky, because it is links, that is you get out there and there's not a tree in sight. There's a derelict castle over in the far distance that you can see kind of hanging off the cliff.
12th century. Norman castle.
And you can see for miles.
Antique castles.
In nearly every direction. And there's, what do you reckon, 7 greens visible from the clubhouse?
Mm. The irony was Gavin, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Gavin said to us, showed us round, took us up to the balcony, showed what we could see from the clubhouse. Not many blind shots out there, boys. We thought there was a lot of stakes out there, but he delivered it in such a dry way that I thought he was being serious. Yeah, and then like, I think nearly every shot was blind in some respects.
I think he wasn't being serious. I don't think he was being serious at all.
No, he was joking.
Yeah,
he
was, yeah. He
sold it brilliantly.
I'd say there were at least, considering there's only 18 holes in the golf course, there are at least 20 blind shots.
Yeah.
There's at least one per hole.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. But like very quickly, once we had a nice bit of food, and we walked out into that course and got on that first fairway. I was like, this doesn't feel like sort of Poana, chalk, top, you know, clifftop golf. This feels like rock hard link stuff. And as we played throughout the whole course, it's consistent. It is legitimate links for me. That's a fast running links golf course.
And it's the micro undulations in the land, you know, yeah. That rumpled land that looks like it's been like you've scrumpled a piece of paper and then stretched it back out. You know, that's the bit that really signifies to me links golf, is that sort of that rumpled land. and it's all rumpled. And we spoke about it in the rounds. So I don't know how it's got here because you're so high up. You're so high above the sea, and you know the sea's crashing around you. And it's like I can't work out how it's here.
The sea hasn't dropped 30 foot because it hasn't done that globally, has it? So I just couldn't for the life of me understand. I mean, more you know, brighter minds will know this, you know, more than us. But yeah, the land was like, it is links. Like, that's the first thing to say. I would say I was probably no more than five holes in at this point, getting my second soaking of the day, because I still refused to put waterproofs on to play golf in, even though I knew it was going to rain. I thought it was going to be a light shower. How wrong I was. Playing five in biblical rain, it was a majestic golf hole. I think I was five holes in thinking, yeah, this is dangerously good, this. And then you play seven with the sun out, rain had stopped, huge undulations in the land, like huge.
It is like the moon.
You lose people in those dunes within the fairway, like huge. And the whole thing went on in similar vein. The amazing thing with Pennard is there was at no point just a boring or bog standard golf hole. And you could totally excuse it. If you just got to 14, it was like, yeah, it's okay. It's just a bit of a straightaway four. This one just gets you to the next. But you can't have that because that land doesn't exist. It's all crazy land. So there is literally no point you're playing anything that is a boring golf hole. There are some that I would say are perhaps a little bit OTT. 17 would stick in my mind as being one of the most bizarre holes I've ever played.
No, I tell you, it told you what to do. 17's a double dogleg par 5. You hit up blind drive, but it tells you where to hit. You hit up to kind of a gentle left to right slope. And then it doglegs right and then immediately doglegs left. And it's left and right is gorse. Death gorse, left and right. But you could advance it 150 yards where you could see it.
Yeah, agreed.
But you knew the green was another 70-odd yards up, a bit further up on the left, but you had to carry all the gorse. And of course,
I just pulled that shot a bit, well, actually. But yeah.
Of course, it gives you enough to think, oh yeah, I could have a crack at this. Whereas it's a par five, like just knock it up there 160 yards and chip it on, you know, pitch on from 70 yards. And then it's an easy five. But
it probably is one of the most breathtaking bits of scenery I've ever played golf on. The land is probably the most exceptional land I've seen on a golf course. Greens were excellent. I mean, in terms of the shapes, there's a huge amount of variety among the golf holes. Yeah, the hype is real about Pennard, and it's, you know, it has benefited from this hype. Like, there's no getting away from it. The green fees are higher there. You know, they've increased their green fees, and they now have 7 green keepers. I dare say 20 years ago they perhaps didn't. But the club still has a wonderfully authentic feel. It hasn't changed in that sense. It's still a really nice place to go. I say that like I've been there 20 years ago. I haven't, but I get the sense it's still, you know, connected. Still
a community club.
Yeah, definitely. It hasn't got carried away with fame and fortune, but the hype is 100% real. Yeah. I mean, breathtaking.
You mentioned about
me. If I had to, like, I feel like I can't just gush about the place. So, you know, what I would say is, I wouldn't do 36 there. I mean, it was windy and we were knackered from getting soaked. It really takes your energy out of you, that does. But it's a bloody big walk.
Difficult walk.
It's huge, huge land to scale.
But it's because of just the vastness and the epicness of each hole.
Yeah.
Which is why it's a big walk. I mean, 10. 10 is a par 5, which it sort of is a big crescent moon-shaped par 5. It kind of goes around 18 with like heather up in the middle. And it's a savagely downhill, you know, to maybe 150 yards short of the green. Then it's savagely uphill. And then you go down to the par 3, 11th.
Same terrain.
And it's a savagely downhill, savagely uphill, 180-yard par 3, which crosses the sort of half pipe that cuts through the golf course. And that type of epic land, you're going to end up doing hard walks.
But your Tembees, your Abu Dhabis, you just loop those on repeat, don't you? But, you know, Pennard, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to come off the 18th green and just feel like you're going to run to the first tee. It takes a bit out of you.
Yeah.
And I think the most, you know, the most brilliant part of that was the way the sun just, it just gives you enough, doesn't it? It's like the, yeah, right, the, it's like the game of golf. It's like, just give us a little bit of sun just to get the drone in the air, because it would be a crying shame not to show how good that golf course looks. And it gave it you for all of about 10 minutes and you just went waz-tastic with the drone.
Yeah, it would have been sad not to be able to express our feelings visually.
Hmm.
And when that sun came out and just dappled across the whole course, it was pretty fitting into the trip. You mentioned that there's not a duff hole at Pennard. I think we'd be going some to say if we played a duff hole on the tour.
Mm. I don't think there was one.
I mean, you could count them on one hand. And bearing in mind that some of these places are cheap to play. Honest Linksland, you know, honest community courses and...
Crazy cheap.
It's...
We're getting little house shares for 100 quid that would sleep three or four. The green fees are averaging around that time of year.
Two figures.
Yeah.
You might pen up as like 125 maybe.
Yeah, and Abu Dhabi and Harlech a little bit. You know, they're decent sized green fees, but shoulder season or go in the peak season... You are not shelling out crazy amounts of money to tee the ball up. Yeah, I mean, like staggeringly good golf. Amazingly overlooked for somewhere that's so close to Scotland, Wales. Scotland, Ireland and England.
Yeah, really. But England is overlooked.
Yeah, of course.
England savagely overlooked for where it is. And Wales is just another stop down the rung. And it's... The whole trip was, I think, absolutely... mind-blowing, and I could not recommend those courses highly enough.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend the trip, as because of what we talked about in the first part of this podcast. It's savage, the amount of travel that we did. But if you want to go loop, you know, a few of them once or twice. So if you do Pennard twice, like Tenby Pennard, they're only an hour and 15 apart.
Great 36 hole day.
It's one of the greatest 36 hole days.
Yeah.
It truly is one of a great.
And Harlech and Abu Dhabi up there with both bolted in and spending a bit of time and maybe playing 36 at Harlech and then going down doing Abu Dhabi and both and then another Abu Dhabi or whatever. Like just spending a bit more time. We say it every time we both bit more than we could chew.
Abu Dhabi as well has got that. I mean, Abu Dhabi was a place as a father. I went there and you kind of look out at the town and the beach, which goes as far as the eye can see in every direction. And you think, yeah, I could spend some time down here. You know, I could bring the kids and, you know, just sneak off for 18 holes when it's like at sunset, but then play with the kids on the beach and go have some nice food. And there's a really lovely hotel, which I think you've frequented. But, and that wasn't, you know, Abu Dhabi was just the one that really stood out for me for that. But that wasn't unique to Abu Dhabi. I mean, Harlech was the same as, beautiful place down there, and Borth again, beautiful place.
I really enjoyed that last day as well. I played a total of 7 clubs. My Joe Powell, so I went back to the TSR 3 round Abu Dhabi. I felt we needed a bit of firepower there. TSR, I went with the Joe Powell persimmon, and then 5 irons and a putter for that day. I quite enjoyed that by the end. That actually was a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah.
That was really good. I think we should say, obviously, huge thank you to FootJoy.
Yep.
Dates. Providing wheels.
Support us on the trip. That's
clothing, everything sure, like that.
Making sure the wheels were clean at the end of every day.
They looked really good, though, didn't they? And to be fair, worked well, those Premiers. I might be in for a pair of Traditions as well. Like
they're lighter on there.
Yeah.
Jim's got Traditions. He was saying they're a bit lighter.
A little lighter. Yeah, I mean, I like the classic golf shoes. I like the Traditions also work. Things like those Lynx Master bags and stuff, and you know, through working on the swing and everything like that, I'm sort of feeling good about the season ahead. But it was a great sort of start to the season. I'm definitely done with wet weather. I hope we've had our fill of wet weather golf. And I think final thanks is really to the clubs and the people. You know, people like Richard Fisher, who's bought books next to me. You know, people, the guys at Borth. You know, all of those people who helped make it such a memorable trip, you know, and was so welcoming and accommodating. You know, yeah, Gavin at Pennard, David at Tenby, I didn't get the chap's name who was adamant Tiger Woods had played at Welsh Pool. You know, he was a delight. It wasn't Tiger. It was Ian Woosnam, who did play his golf there and then moved down the road.
But no, fantastic people, fantastic venue. And I think it's overlooked, but I couldn't recommend it highly enough. So, you know, if you please do get in touch if you want any advice on setting up a trip like this. Sam did a good job of you know, working out the itinerary and stuff. If you take any of our advice, it's most accessible and affordable trip that we've done to date. So
yeah, apart from that Hebrides, well,
which isn't really that accessible, but so in fact, it's not accessible.
So, it's accessible if you live in Birmingham. It's highly accessible if you live in Birmingham.
Well, yeah, and you're willing to drive for best part of 40 hours.
And well done with the drive. Good, big thank you to you
and the van
for the driving. The and van thank again. You to Luke for taking photos, and thank you for Jim
for cleaning shoes
to a fairly good standard, I would say.
That's it for this one, and until next time.
Adios. Watch this.